feel a little bit like I'm stepping out on a tightrope with the things that I want to say tonight. A few of you will recognise bits of this sermon from conversations you've had with me during the week, because a few of you had some questions arising from last week's sermon, and my wrestling with your questions has kind of shaped this week's sermon. Some of these ideas emerged from the readings anyway, and perhaps in some ways the gospel writer and the apostle were walking the same tightrope, because the ideas continued to unfold in the next sections, which we heard tonight. Feels like a tightrope because you don't have to step very far either side of the truth here to be in serious trouble. The question or the issue is freedom. Freedom. What it is and what it isn't. Over the last few weeks, we've heard the Apostle Paul say things like, I might be free to do anything, but that doesn't mean everything's a good idea. And don't use your superior freedom in ways that cause others to stumble. And in tonight, he's talking about the freedom to do as the Romans do when in Rome. Or is he? You can see Paul on the tightrope. Yes, if you're free, you're free, but don't overdo it. And it's very tempting for preachers like me, who are also pastors, and I suspect a little of this was going on for Paul, to want to tighten the reins even a bit more than what Paul does here, to qualify these images of freedom with even more buts. We want to proclaim freedom in Christ, but we're fearful that some sort of mindless pursuit of freedom will lead to anarchy and fracturing of community. Most tightrope walkers use a long balance pole, a thing that reaches out over the abyss in both directions for balance. Gary Deverill described the preacher's balance pole one time when he said that in order to faithfully preach the truth, a preacher has to preach one heresy one week and the opposite one the next week. On a specific topic of freedom, Martin Luther sounded a bit like he was using the balance pole as well when he said, a Christian is a perfectly free lord of all, subject to none, and a Christian is a perfectly dutiful servant of all, subject to all. So what is freedom really? Is it a bit of an illusion? Is it just a redrawing of the boundaries? Is it really more like the freedom of Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, with the freedom to be blissfully happy and healthy and comfortable and entertained all the time is yours so long as you live in absolute conformity to the rules that protect the balance of this nirvana? Is that what really is going on when Paul talks about Christ as the end of the law and then in the next breath speaks of a new law, the law of Christ, the law of love? Are we really free or aren't we? In wrestling with this, I want us to look first at the stories that we heard from Mark's Gospel both last week and this. In these stories, freedom is not discussed anywhere as a concept, but it is brought into being in very concrete ways. It is experienced. And if our theories ever get too removed from lived experience, they're probably not much use. So let's start with these stories. Last week, we heard of Jesus being confronted by a man with an unclean spirit in the synagogue. And rather than throw the man out, Jesus throws the unclean spirit out and leaves the man free. This week's story started with the words, as soon as they left the synagogue, so that we know that what's going to happen next has some continuity both in time and in meaning. As soon as they left the synagogue, Jesus and his followers went to Simon Peter's house, where Simon Peter's mother-in-law was very sick, and Jesus heals her, setting her free from the illness that was confining her to bed, And then word gets out, and by nightfall there is a huge crowd just outside the house with every family in town bringing those who were suffering from illnesses or disabilities or demonic afflictions, and Jesus sets many of them free from the things that laid them low. Now, perhaps you're already catching on to what I'm doing here, playing with the language so that the idea of being healed morphs into the idea of being set free. You see, our concept of freedom varies depending on our experience, depending on where we are looking at it from. Those who are blind dream of the freedom to see. Those who are bedridden dream of the freedom to go outside and run through the grass. Those who are in prison dream of the freedom to be outside the walls. Those who are being bullied or blackmailed or who are impoverished or hungry or exploited or oppressed dream of much more concrete and specific expressions of freedom than those of us who are privileged and have the luxury of philosophizing about the nature of absolute freedom. But at the same time, perhaps those of us who have such luxuries are also crippled and confined by the brave new world that has taught us to think of ourselves as free even when we're not. Maybe. Sometimes that brave new world simply seems to prescribe more and more entertainments and medications and distractions to keep us blissfully ignorant of our own enslavement. That's certainly how Huxley saw it. And if that's true, then maybe we have no one to carry us to Jesus' door because our afflictions have been declared normal and perhaps even desirable. And yet, that quiet yearning for freedom continues to stir restlessly within us and will not be silenced. The Apostle Paul, in the letter that we're hearing to the Corinthian church, gets a little bit more theoretical and theological about the concept of freedom, but he still grounds his discussion repeatedly in practical examples. Last week, he was talking about ethical freedoms. I might be sure that I am ethically free to have a beer without causing any offence to God. But that doesn't mean that I should regard myself as free to sit in on a meeting of the Christian Temperance Association with a beer in my hand, or to walk into an AA meeting and pour myself a beer. What Paul wants to stress is that the voluntary nature, he's stressing the voluntary nature of this limitation of our freedom. If you think of it only in terms of the loss of your freedom to have a beer every time you feel like it, then you can quickly persuade yourself that your freedom is being eroded. But if you think of it in terms of being set free for a relationship with these brothers and sisters who have a problem with alcohol, it's a threat for them, then you're becoming closer to the meaning of freedom in Christ. If this is not becoming clear, let me scale it down even a little bit more to the completely individual level. I happen to like drinking beer, which will probably come as no surprise to most of you. If I had no reason not to, I would probably have a beer with my evening meal every night, and for many years I pretty much did. This past year, I have drunk a lot less beer. It was not for any ethical reason. I just decided that it was time to get serious about reversing my trend of putting on a kilo a year for the last 20 years. Another 20 years and I was going to be hitting about 120 kilos, and I decided that I just didn't want to go there. And I realised that continuing to exercise my freedoms to drink all the beer I liked and to have thirds after every dessert was not compatible with my freedom to reverse the trajectory of my middle-age spread. So if I approach the question of freedom merely as a philosopher, then I would conclude that I am not truly, absolutely free. I cannot have this and this both at the same time. I have to choose one or the other. There are laws of the physical universe, even of my own little bodily universe, that limit my freedom to claim both this freedom and this freedom at the same time. But does that mean that I'm not really free? Is it not more truly the case that my God-given freedom lies in my ability to exercise that choice, to decide which was more important to me, the beer or the belly, and choose accordingly? You see, if I was an alcoholic, my freedom would be much more constrained. For me, cutting back the beer was just a commitment. For an alcoholic, it would be a pitched battle. And this is where the rubber really hits the road in our quest to clarify what freedom means and what it looks like. See, freedom as an abstract concept is not really very helpful because it actually doesn't have much to do with life as we live it. Theoretical absolute freedom would presumably mean freedom from things like the laws of gravity too. But such theories don't have any practical relevance for our lives. Freedom as an abstract concept always seems to mean freedom from the other. Freedom to live my life without regard to what anybody else thinks or wants or needs. But the freedom that Jesus offers us is not an abstract freedom from others, but a freedom for. Freedom for God, freedom for others, freedom for love. You see, whenever anybody has gotten close to any kind of absolute freedom from everything, from every constraining relationship, expectation, or cultural norm, they don't experience it as freedom at all, or at least not as any kind of freedom that could be regarded as a gift. Instead, they experience it as lostness, as rootlessness, aimlessness, meaninglessness. It's more like the freedom to keep falling into the abyss without any rescuing hand to reach out and catch you. As Karl Barth noted, Christian freedom does not assume a neutral stance as though we were in the garden, standing before the tree and able to choose either good or evil. He says, the knowledge of good and evil is not the solution, it's the problem. When we abstract it and regard it as though it were a meaningless choice, pure freedom leaves us feeling utterly lost. And we are. But in the real world, we don't stand before the tree with a purely meaningless freedom to choose either good or evil as though it made no difference to anything. Mostly our choices are shaped and constrained and channeled by the patterns of choices that we have been exposed to since birth and that we see all around us and that are promoted and advertised and discussed and so on and so forth. So we find ourselves desiring what we see others desiring. When Eve stood at the tree, her choice was shaped by the contagious desire expressed by the serpent. And when Adam approached the tree, he in turn imitated the pattern of desire he saw Eve expressing. And so on, and so on, and so on. And so we find ourselves not really that free at all, but overwhelmingly pushed towards choosing wrongly. And so when strangers approach our shores seeking refuge, and we can choose to pick the fruit of hospitality or the fruit of hostile possessiveness, we all too readily imitate one another's fearful rejection of the stranger. And when someone lashes out and wounds us, and we can choose to eat the fruit of mercy and reconciliation, or to eat the fruit of vengeance and retribution, we all too readily imitate the wounding we received and reciprocate it, usually with interest. The freedom to so choose might be a freedom in some abstract theoretical sense, but it is not the freedom that Jesus came to offer us. And like the alcoholic trying to lose his beer gut, if you try to choose against the flow, you will quickly discover that it is far from being an equally free choice. Christian freedom is not a simple matter of being able to choose, but being able to choose well, being able to choose rightly. It is, in as much as it is a freedom from, it is a freedom from all that would oppress and impede you from being what you could otherwise be. From all that binds you and weighs you down and presses you into the mould of contagious fearfulness and hostility and possessiveness and bitterness and jealousy. It is Jesus meeting the sick and disabled and demonised outside his door and setting them free. Free from all that binds them to a life that is less than what they were created to live. It is Jesus meeting you at the door and wanting to set you free from all that prevents you from choosing rightly to live generously and expansively and joyously. So when we hear Paul talking this week about his cultural freedom to become all things to all people, he's not talking about the valueless imitation of the when in Rome do as the Romans do. It's not, you know, when with the violent do as the violent do, when with the selfish and indulgent do as the selfish and indulgent do. Paul is not advocating the freedom to just do as one pleases and selfishly indulge whatever desires one wants to copy. What he's talking about is the freedom to freely lay aside one's own ways and desires in order to be free to relate to the other. Freedom in Christ is not freedom from gravity or from every expectation or obligation. Rather, it is a specific way of relationship. In Christ, we are set free from our ingrained tendencies to imitate one another in a downward spiral of jealousy and hostility. And instead, we are liberated to imitate Jesus. Freedom in Christ is the freedom to reconcile, freedom to liberate, freedom to forgive. It is the freedom to begin doing these things even when everything around you would be hurting you in the opposite direction. At the cross, we were shown how much we were in bondage to those patterns of sin and death and the devil. But in the resurrection, we are given liberation, freedom, grace. We are set free to choose to live the life that the persistent whisper inside us has kept us vaguely aware of and restlessly yearning for. Like those desperate, broken people gathered around the door looking to Jesus for freedom, we gather here around his word and table looking for the same freedom. Jesus is here. Receive freely. Embrace your freedom to imitate Jesus. Welcome, forgive, reconcile, love freely.